The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is the 12 Songs of Christmas. My name is Alex Rawls, and this is my podcast about Christmas music. One of the through lines this holiday season is my guests have been in the indie world. Last week, I talked to Jim Goodwin of the website Christmas Underground, who uncovers good indie Christmas music, and this week my guests all come from that world. I'm going to talk to indie producer and DJ Amerigo Gazaway, who has a number of Christmas projects, musician Charlie Darling, who records under the name Les Bicyclettes de Belsize, and journalist Kevin McGrath, who pulled together more than 100 indie rock Christmas songs for Have Yourself a Merry Indie Christmas, Volumes 1 and 2, both of which are available now on Bandcamp. This interest extends to the writing I do on my blog, myspiltmilk.com. I've always had a hard time accepting the idea that the good music already happened, and through no fault of your own, you missed it. In non-Christmas music, I've always rejected the idea that the best music happened in the 60s and that we're living in the aftermath. And where Christmas music is concerned, I love the classics, but at some point, I got tired of trying to map my holiday experiences onto singers and songs from the 1950s and 60s. There's a lot of music from that period that moves me, but I spent the last 30 years looking for Christmas music that comes from the same world I do. I love sleigh ride, but that hasn't been a legitimate mode of transportation for more than a century. My experience is closer to that of Charlie Darling, who sings in An Indie Rock Christmas about being disappointed when he saw the Primitives and they didn't play Crash. In the first season of 12 Songs, I talked to Chris Butler of The Waitresses about how much I liked the way that their Christmas Wrapping was a song about single people in their 20s who lived skint, messy lives that were focused on weekend nights in the clubs. I recognize those people, whereas the people in Perry Como or Andy Williams songs only existed for me in movies. Indie, in this case, is more about a means of production and funding than a specific sound. It might lack a little polish, but it's not limited to any genre. Producer and DJ Amerigo Gazaway works. I regularly get updates from his Bandcamp page notifying me of the new collaborations, including this year's Strangers, Back to the Lab, a collaboration with rapper Megaran on music based on the most recent season of Stranger Things. A few years ago, I interviewed Megaran about his Very Random Christmas album for the podcast, where we talked about how each song on it was based on a sample from the Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack. I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. Gazaway released a few Christmas mixtapes before he recorded a Christmas album titled A Christmas Album in 2018. It's a series of instrumentals, but he has also released a remixed version with vocals attached. And they're very cool, and I think you'll like what he does with it. This holiday season, he's made both of those available as a package on vinyl. I'm not sure if he's sold out yet as of this point, so if you're interested, check his Bandcamp page. Anyway, we'll delve into a little hip-hop Christmas and his projects, starting with Santa's Workshop from A Christmas Album. We'll be back on the other side with Amerigo Gazaway on 12 Songs.
Thank you.
I'm talking to you from Zagreb, Croatia, right?
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
So I know you're from Nashville. So how did we get from Nashville to Croatia?
Yeah, good question. Basically, yeah, my wife is Croatian. I met her in Nashville. And then we moved to California for a little while. And then during the pandemic, we moved out here because she got a job in Croatia. And now we're based here in Zagreb.
So you're pretty prolific. How does being there affect your work?
I mean, it's good. The moving during the pandemic was definitely just a crazy transitional period for all of us, I think. And so that kind of threw me off, and I kind of lost some momentum there because, you know, I was just moving and, you know, just getting settled into the new environment and new country. But yeah, now that I've got my studio set up again, I'm getting back into the groove and the momentum that I was in before, which is, you know, being prolific and putting out stuff. And we actually just bought an apartment, so we're excited about that. And we're going to be moving into there soon and setting up a new studio there. So I'll have a new workspace and hopefully my wife too. And so, I think it's affected me in a positive way. You know, I do miss being like surrounded by some of my peers and being able to just, be a little bit more part of a scene. Like when I was in the Bay Area, especially, like there was a lot of events going on, there were shows, you know, Bun B would come through town and I'd go say, what's up? Or, you know, there would be like hip hop events. I DJ'd more, you know, I would connect with people a little more, but I've actually started to connect with some of the DJs out here too. And that's been really cool too. And diving into some of like the ex-Yugoslavian jazz and funk and soul scene and, you know, flipping some of those records and, yeah, I've played some gigs out here too, and so it's starting to pay off in a lot of different ways, and just the overhead of, you know, living out here versus living in the Bay Area, which was super expensive, and so now I actually have the, you know, our overhead is lower, but, you know, now I have more money to, or, you know, a little bit more ability to like play around with ideas, buy merch, or, you know, invest in merch to sell to fans, or, you know, execute cool concepts and ideas that, you know, I might not have had the funds or resources to do otherwise. So,
right.
So yeah, in those ways, it's affected my career and my prolificness positively, I guess.
is it easier to just, you know, to get in and grind when you have fewer distractions around you?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think the time zone difference has also kind of played into that because, you know, now during the daytime here, like a lot of my friends and fans and everybody I used to like kind of keep in touch with is asleep. And so like, I kind of get that, distraction free time during the day now here, whereas when I was living in the States, maybe not, you know, maybe people would be texting me or contacting me or, you know, hitting me up while I'm working more. And so now I think, you know, I have a little less distraction because of the time zone thing. And so, I think that's helpful. Just in general, yeah, I think just, you know, having less distractions, like, you know, there are events that, you know, occasionally, like, you know, like I said, I've been hooking up with the DJs around here DJing and, you know, occasionally like Rakim will come to town or some, you know, famous rapper or hip hop legend will come through. And of course we'll come out and support. So there's still events and quote unquote distractions, but not as many. So yeah, I think I am getting more into a groove of being more productive in the studio and just cranking out a lot of material. Cause I've just been sitting on a lot of stuff. I have a hard drive full of music that I want to release into the world to make space, like physically and emotionally, for me to create new stuff. And I'm also, you know, exploring like different sides to my artistry too, because, you know, I've been doing the mashup remix thing for a long time, but I really want to start exploring more of like the instrumental beat production side of what I do, and also rapping as well, which is something I enjoy doing. So this is kind of given me the time to kind of explore some of those things as well.
Oh, that's great. I wonder about something you just said. I want to ask you to see if you could expand a little on it, because I think this is really interesting. Talking about sort of not being able to really move on until you get a certain amount of the material that you've kind of got backlogged out into the world. Can you talk a little about that? Because I think that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's you know, it's something I've tried to become better at over the years, because I am a perfectionist, and I did used to sit on a lot of my material until it became outdated, until it becomes irrelevant, you know, and but then by the time you want to put out it out into the world, it doesn't even make sense, or it doesn't align with how you're feeling at the moment anymore. And so, you know, lately I've been trying to just really put things out in the moment that I feel they need to be released in, you know, and not hold on to them forever. Or, you know, like with producers and hip hop, especially, like a lot of times we'll make beats, but we'll save it for, you know, oh, maybe if I meet Jay-Z one day, you know, he'll rap on this beat or whatever. You will save our beats, or we'll save our tracks for different things. Like, no, like link up with the best MC in your city or your community or in your network and put it out and like move on to the next, or rap on it yourself, or do a remix with it or something. So I'm really trying to look at my hard drive now and just figure out, like, you know, where does this, like a music supervisor would almost, like, where does this track belong? Like, should it be placed in a film or commercial? Should it be a soundtrack? Should it have a rapper on it? Should it have an MC on it? Should it be an instrumental track? Where does it belong? And how can I facilitate getting it there? Because, you know, it's useless sitting on my hard drive in a graveyard of beats, you know. Right. It needs to exist in the world. And the more I do that, the more I'm inspired and fueled to do that even more, because it's just a, you know, a circle, you know, or a self-fulfilling prophecy, because, you know, the more stuff I put out, the more feedback I get from fans, and that inspires me to keep moving. And now that, you know, now that I'm putting out some of this, is, you know, like I said, I've been doing the mashups for a really long time, and I'm only now really starting to explore kind of like the instrumental side of what I do and some of the other things that I do. And now that I'm putting that stuff out, I'm starting to see people that are, you know, really like affected by it, or they're really, it's helping them get through their day or their week or something like that. You know, a beat that's just been sitting on my hard drive for 10 years is helping somebody, like, you know, get through their midterm finals or whatever it is in college, like, or, you know, helping them bond over hip hop with their kids or something. So, you know, it's just like, when I see stuff like that, it's just like, it inspires me and makes me want to, you know, not hold on to things and really just keep moving and getting better, you know, because, like, I think, we can get stuck. It's easy to get stuck in perfectionism, you know,
mm-hmm.
sometimes.
Are you starting to connect with rappers in your region? Starting to find people to collaborate with there?
A little bit more so DJs right now, but I do want to start connecting with some of the MCs and rappers, in the region. You know, I still don't understand Croatian fully, but I am learning, and music is definitely a big part of that, you know, like listening to Croatian music and digging at the record stores for Croatian ex-Yugoslavian jazz and funk and soul, and then, you know, yeah, connecting with some of the DJs here. They're putting me on to different rappers and MCs around here, but I haven't really connected with any MCs around here particularly, but I do want to start doing that. And, you know, I have been connecting with like Napoleon, the Legend, and other MCs like that. He's in Berlin, and rappers like A1 and Megaran and, you know, people all over that I respect and, you know, look up to and want to work with, you know? And so, yeah, it's been awesome to kind of like, be part of a collaborative process, you know. Like for years I've been very like hermit-like in my studio, just making these mashups and doing everything by myself. And I've only now recently kind of started to collaborate more with other people. And that's been really, really great, because, you know, there's always something other people bring to the table, and it's really excited to have somebody on the other end, you know, fueling that fire and that motivation. So,
yeah, I was about to ask you about collaborating. You just recently released an album with Megaran. Was it Strangers, Back to the Lab? And he had done, after the first season of Stranger Things, he had done an album or EP of tracks that were all about Stranger Things. And y'all just did one based on the fourth season, right?
Yeah. I mean, it kind of covers a little bit of all of it, but yeah, it was more kind of inspired by the fourth season. All the track names on the project are episode titles from the fourth season.
It's like you're not even here anymore. across the blacktop. By the time I trimmed the fro and got the flat top, Walkman in hand, no Hot Wheels or Matchbox. They move crack rocks, nines in the stash box. Catching the bus to high school in the fall. Nerds playing the shadows, bullies ruling the hall. Now I'm caught in the middle and find myself upside down, trying to make sense of it all. Staying in trouble.
Tell me about the process of collaborating with Mega or with any of the people you just, Napoleon the Legend. Any of these people, tell me about the process of collaborating from this distance.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is, you know, I've only met Mega Ran once in person. I met him at like a game conference in California. I rushed him and said, what's up to him. And because I mean, I've always been a huge fan and now it's great to actually work with him. But, you know, I've still never met Napoleon in person. I'm actually going to Berlin in December. So I'm looking forward to actually linking up with Napoleon in person too. But you know, it's still, you know, really great. Like the friendship is still there. You know, we talk and communicate often, and you know, it still feels like we know each other, and you know, the distance hasn't really affected, you know, the collaborative process so much. Although it would be great to be like in the same room at some point. That's what I look forward to doing maybe more in the future when we have the resources to either fly them here or, you know, meet up in the same city. But no, it's been great. You know, like, with the Mega Ran project, that came about basically, I started working on like a Stranger Things remix, for the fourth season. I think I was writing to the Kate Bush thing, Running Up the Hill. And then, I think I posted something like a little snippet on Instagram or something about it. Just like, hey, I'm working on the Stranger Things project, like stay tuned, and Mega Ran saw it and hit me up, and he was like, oh, you're working on something, I'm working on something too. So that's kind of how that came about. And so we started collaborating and throwing ideas back and forth, and since I had already written like four verses to the Kate Bush Running Up the Hill thing, so it didn't make sense for him to get on that, I was like, well, let's do a different joint. So we sampled the Metallica joint, the Master of Puppets. And then once we did that, and I was just like, well, why don't we just do a whole, you know, volume two for your Strangers, you know, project that you did. So that's kind of how that project evolved. And then it really just happened like in a whirlwind of like a week, you know, like his producers were sending beats, I was making beats and rapping on all them. And, you know, we just cooked it all up over like a week. My friend Art Webb helped me mix and master it. And we put it out. And so that was really fun also. Just kind of, it was almost like a jam session or like a homework assignment that we just had to get done. And I like working like that too, you know, just kind of giving yourself limitations because of that perfectionism can kind of be debilitating sometimes to the creative process. So
you've had a really pretty varied and active career making a lot of different kinds of beats. But you're particularly associated with sort of mashups and kind of like next level combinations of music and vocals that didn't initially live together. What makes your mashups different from others?
That's a good question. Yeah. I mean, you know, with the mashup projects that I do, the Soulmates projects in particular, you know, I really try to think of, you know, the artists that I'm combining and why they should be combined and what makes sense about that. And, you know, I'll even go as deep as, you know, reading their autobiographies and really finding out, like, you know, things about their stories and their histories and their lives that coincide or maybe overlap, and working that into the project. And so I think there's like a level of research that I do with those projects that I think maybe some mashup artists don't necessarily do with their blend tapes. You know, there's a lot of great blend tape artists out there that are doing mashups that are great. You know, it's awesome for the DJs. It's awesome for, you know, radio shows. It's awesome just for listening. But it's with my projects, I really am trying to give it like a more educational element, I guess, and really kind of give the listener like a glimpse of who those artists are, you know, what their personal like stories were involved with their music, and then like how that related to their music, and it's almost like an audio documentary in a way and a tribute in a way. And so I think that's what kind of separates or, you know, kind of makes my projects a little bit different from other mashup projects. And I also try to like yeah, just make it seem like they're in the studio together live, that they're, you know, having a conversation basically. And I'll do things where I find things that they're talking about and have them finish each other's sentences or finish each other's lines and words or thoughts, you know, musically, and, you know, really make it so that they're on the same song together and they're talking about the same, singing or rapping about the same topics, and they're actually like having that conversation. So it's more than just finding like a nice BPM and a nice acapella that syncs up in key, you know, which is also fun too.
The first Christmas projects I'm aware of from you are the hip-hop Christmas mixtapes. Were those your first, you know, sort of attempts to do something with Christmas music?
Let's see. The first Christmas thing I did, I think, was the Crunk Christmas mix, which is just an utterly ridiculous mix mash of like the most obnoxious, unfamily friendly Christmas music you could think of. It's just a guilty pleasure mix that I made one night. I think I was actually performing with my friend This Is Art that night at 12th and Porter in Nashville, and you know, I think we were opening up for some big electronic DJ or something like that. So the crowd, they were there to party. They wanted to turn up. They wanted to get live. But I also wanted to work because it was like close to, it was like the week of Christmas or something. I also wanted to work Christmas into the mix. So I found like, you know, a collection of the most crazy, crunkest, trappiest trap Christmas songs that I could find, and you know, made this. It's like a 15-20 minute mini mix or something, but it's got like Ludacris in it and Diplo and Major Lazer and Eazy-E and like, you know, a bunch of crazy stuff, just off the wall Christmas stuff that you would never expect. So that was the first Christmas mix that I did, and like I said, it was just kind of a joke fun thing, but it's actually become like a staple. Like a lot of my fans tell me like they listen to it every year, like their Christmas isn't the same unless they listen to it once a year. And it's funny how that mix has taken off sort of. And then after that, a few years later, I do love Christmas. Obviously I've done a lot of Christmas mixes. So, a few years later I did the Players Holiday Christmas mixtape, which is a little bit more, it's definitely not as crazy or obnoxious as the Crunk Christmas. It's a little more family friendly. There's maybe some bad, naughty Santa stuff in there, like soul songs, blues songs, you know, about backdoor Santas and stuff like that. But it's mostly like more funk and soul and hip hop, like Christmas mixtape that you can actually kind of listen to in more of a party or, you know, dinner family setting. After the Players Holiday mixtape, I did the actual Christmas album, which is like more of an instrumental beat tape, Christmas beat tape, reinterpreting a bunch of my favorite like Christmas classics.
Right. Let's come back to that one in a minute before we get away from get away from the previous ones with Players Ball
or Players Holiday.
Holiday. Sorry. That. One of the things that I've been thinking about is hip hop Christmas. And I had Megaran on the show a few years ago talking about hip hop Christmas. And I've done a few Christmas hip hop shows, but for me, it's always a challenge. There's not a lot. And most people point to about the same four or five Christmas songs. And that's kind of all that they can think of. As somebody who has both tried to DJ, work with it, and who likes Christmas music, do you have sort of either favorite Christmas songs or frustrations with hip-hop Christmas music or thoughts about Christmas hip-hop Christmas music in general?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's definitely a niche thing. It's it's funny because, you know, hip hop has kind of this macho gangster kind of appeal to it that, you know, like Christmas doesn't necessarily jive with or fit in with, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons you don't see more hip hop Christmas stuff, because it's hard to be gangster and hard when you're, you know, talking about jingle bells and wearing a beard or Santa hat or whatever. But you know, I think that, you know, some people have done it well, and you know, with the Christmas, like the Players Holiday Mix, for instance, you know, like there is only like a handful of really good listenable hip hop Christmas songs to pull from. So that was a challenge. But then, you know, that's also why I also kind of started getting creative and thinking outside the box that's why I called it Players Holiday, because then I included the track Players Holiday, and then I included a bunch of other hip hop songs about holidays, you know, every day is a holiday, another dollar day, you know. And so I kind of started to think of outside the box, like what are some songs, hip hop songs that are Christmas songs without that aren't Christmas songs, you know what I mean? It's about a holiday, or it's about giving thanks, or it's about feasting or giving gifts or something like that. So that's, I guess, one way around it that I tried to like expand my pool of songs to use when I was trying to come up with a DJ mix, was, you know, coming up with, and you know, not just hip hop, but yeah, funk songs, soul songs. You know, one of my friends a few years ago did a great like Thanksgiving mix, and it was all just songs about food, you know, like Green Onions, Booker T, or like stuff like, it wasn't like songs about Thanksgiving necessarily, right. But you know, there's ways you can do it like that. But yeah, I think, you know, I don't know. I think one of the reasons I did I do these Christmas tapes, and I do especially the Christmas album that I did, was because a lot of the, not necessarily hip hop, but just like reinterpretations of Christmas music that I hear tend to be like a little bit unlistenable. Like, not, like I said, not so much hip hop, but more so like in just the EDM or the electronic realm. Like anytime you type in just Christmas remix, you know, and Google it on YouTube, it's usually just really bad and unlistenable. And so like, I just wanted to make something that was, you know, family friendly, that like you could throw on in the background. It's groovy, it's chill. But you can also party to it and, you know, open presents, whatever. So
what was your experience with Christmas music growing up?
My experience with Christmas music, well, actually the whole, going back to the Christmas album thing, the whole project was kind of inspired by,
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
These mixtapes that my dad used to get sent to him from this guy named Beetle Bob.
I've met Beetle Bob.
And you've heard of Beetle Bob?
I've met Beetle Bob, yeah.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so my dad is on his mailing list, and he sends out every year, he sends out these amazing Christmas mixes. And, you know, that's what we listened to growing up. I remember being a kid growing up. My dad, he's a jazz musician. He toured as Gary Gasaway, El Buho. And so Beetle Bob would always come to his shows. And yeah, my dad ended up on his mailing list, and we would get these CDs every year. And it was just a total mix of Christmas holiday novelty songs from all different genres, as you can imagine, like from rockabilly to reggae to punk to hip hop, whatever. And so those were really inspiring growing up. And every year I was excited to go visit my dad, because that meant I get to rip or burn the new Beetle Bob Christmas mixtape for that year. And then I'd take it back to Nashville and listen to it. And that's actually how I discovered a lot of these songs. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of the songs from those mixtapes ended up being sampled on some of these mixes and projects that I've done. So, but you know, Beetle Bob would also take the time to like put in all these little skits and interludes in the mixtapes too, of like different snippets from Christmas movies and commercials and old records and holiday jingles and stuff like that. And so that was really inspiring as well as a hip hop head. You know, it was very like a something a hip hop person would do, I guess. Even though I wouldn't associate Beetle Bob as particularly hip hop. But anyway, so the Christmas album that I did, you know, includes a lot of those little skits and samples and snippets, you know, kind of in tribute to that. And yeah, so that was kind of my experience growing up. Basically, just listen, those Beetle Bob mixtapes were the Christmas soundtrack. That and my stepmom used to listen to the Carpenters' Christmas a lot. She used to wear that out. So,
has that shown up yet?
Not yet. Not yet. But I am considering doing. My wife said I should do another Christmas album, Volume 2, and call it another Christmas album. So there might be another one in the works, but
it's Christmas time. It's Christmas time. It's Christmas time. It's Christmas time.
So when you made a Christmas album, there's two versions of it, right? There's the one that is simply the instrumentals, and then there's the version with vocals attached.
Yeah, the remixes.
Yeah. Did they come out together or slightly apart? What was the story?
I think they actually came out together. Yeah, I did the Christmas album, and then a lot of times when in my creative process, I'll work on something, and then the last moment, I'll do something drastic or change something about the project, or I'll add to it, or I'm very sporadic like that. So and this was one of those occasions where I did finish the Christmas album, I was about to put it out, I was about to press the button, I was like, you know what, I should do some remixes, why not do some remixes? So I just did some remixes. It was like I did it in like a week or two or a few days or something. I came up with the whole remixes version because also I had recently started my subscription and thing, and so I wanted to kind of have like a different version of like bonus content for the subscribers. So now I'm trying to, when I put out a project, sometimes now I'm like, well, how can I, put out another version of the project for the subscribers? It's like more bonus or, includes more content. And so that was kind of one of the thought processes behind it. But also, the moment I started playing around with it, the songs just came together, like the Erykah Badu, and, some of those songs just really feel like they were meant to go together. And again, I was kind of trying to go for acapellas or, songs that maybe lent themselves to Christmas or Christmas emotions, like the song Cry or Lonely Christmas, with Jay-Z, or, I was trying to pick songs that might fit with the Christmas theme, both lyrically and like sonically. So
it's Christmas.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and Pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, Rap Attack, it's Mr. Magic, Marley Mall. I let my tape rock to my tape pop. Smoking weed and bamboo, sipping on private stock. Way back when I had the red and black lumberjack with the hat to match. Remember rapping?
By now, you've had enough of a career and done enough. I'd imagine there are people who both want mixes, and there are people who simply want to hear, hear your musical work and want to hear what you make. So things like you would have an audience for the instrumental version in addition to the remix, I would assume.
Yeah. I think, like I said, I think over the past 5 years or so, I've started to build more of an audience for my instrumental stuff and some of the other facets of what I do. Again, I think those first 5 years, I was just kind of going hard with the mashups. And then I started to kind of put a little bit more of myself out there. And now that I've done that, I think it's not as strange and it's not as weird for me to drop something else that's not a mixtape or a mashup anymore. Whereas before it was like, people might've been a little bit confused. It's funny because, I started out before all the mashup stuff, I was doing this. I was making beats, I was making instrumentals, I was writing raps, I was making hip hop, and the mashup thing kind of was just a sidetrack journey to where I am now. And I do plan to continue doing it, when I have like an idea that sparks my imagination. But but at the same time, you know, I have to like evolve as an artist too. So.
Oh, sure. I found Charlie Darling and Les Bicyclettes de Belsize by accident. Andy Partridge of XTC released an EP of Christmas music this year titled My Failed Christmas Songwriting Career, and I was looking online to see if it existed in digital spaces. So far, it doesn't. But while searching Bandcamp, I found a song titled Andy Partridge, which was a version of the 12 Songs of Christmas using band names with numbers as the lyrics, with each verse ending not with a partridge in a pear tree, but Andy Partridge from XTC. That's on Les Bicyclettes de Belsize's 2018 album, The 12 Songs of Christmas, which I immediately liked, and as I checked out the band's page, I found that it had actually a lot of Christmas music. I reached out to Charlie Darling to talk about the project, Christmas music, and after we hear Andy Partridge, which he had to retitle A Partridge in a Pear Tree for the streaming services, we'll hear that interview.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me Andy Partridge from XTC. On the second day of Christmas, my true love gave to me Two Tries by Frankie, Andy Partridge from XTC. Christmas, my true love gave to me Three Dog Night, Two Live Crew, Andy Partridge from XTC.
So I want to start that with sort of the newest thing that I just saw that, I guess, the beginning of the month, that the Have Yourself an Indie Christmas yes. compilation, sort of a two batches of music came out. And you had the yes. title track, Have Yourself an Indie Christmas. Can you tell me about the compilation yeah. and the song?
Well, the compilation was a guy in Bristol called Kevin. And I think he put out an album last year for charity, for Crisis at Christmas. And I don't know if you know in the States, but Crisis are a homeless charity. And they look after the homeless, and particularly at Christmas. Obviously, you know, it's cold, it's wet, it's miserable here in the UK. and they do a lot of work to make sure that people are fed. They are given shelter over the Christmas period, and they're looked after, they're cleaned up, and that sort of thing. So he had the idea, I think, last year of putting out an album of Christmas songs, and he wanted to do it again this year. So, and he managed to get, I think, nearly 100 artists or so, and just for a double album, and everyone was just generously, you know, donating their tracks. I mean, bands that I love, The Lilac Time. I'm a huge fan of Stephen Duffy and his work, and to be on an album with him, that was enough for me. I was just like, yeah, of course I'll do it. So that was, and there's so many. I think there's bands from all over the world. There's lots of bands from the States on there. There's the English band. There's a track by Helen Love, who you may or may not know. I'm on that as well. I'm singing. It's one of those ones where she invited lots of different people to sing a line.
Oh, cool.
It's one of those like celebrity, well, the world type, but without famous people right. like me. So I've got a line on that. So I'm on two songs. And Kevin was just like, yeah, I really like the idea of, you know, an indie Christmas. And he'd heard my track. And so he thought that would be a good one to put on there. So I was really pleased with that. It's a bit of a fun song. It's about, I got the idea from being a bit tired of hearing Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas. And I thought, what do I want for Christmas? And I don't want to hear Mariah Carey and the usual all the time. And I thought, well, what do I want? I want bands that I like.
Right.
So it's a purely selfish sort of record. I want to hear the Orchids. I want to hear Stephen Duffy and Edwin Collins and Helen Love and Friends Again, who are a particular favourite of mine. I want to hear those bands. So if someone bought me presents and those the presents were those records, that's it. That's all I want for Christmas.
Right.
I sat on a hill lighting D tracks, watching the primitives, but they didn't play Crash. In a London bar called the Borderline, to see the lilac time, there was a cancelled sign. Now all I want for Christmas are the orchids on C86. All I want for Christmas is Helen Love and Tallulah Gosh. All I want for Christmas are Friends Again and orange juice. All I want for Christmas is you.
On your Bandcamp page, that
yes.
I think 7 of the 20 releases on there are Christmas releases.
Yes. Guilty.
Why make Christmas such a part of your musical identity?
I think it's something that I just love the idea of Christmas songs. Obviously, growing up with the big hits of the day, you know, your Slades and your Paul McCartney and things like that. And I think a few years ago, I set myself a challenge of trying to write one a year. And I just sort of kept going. And I just always, in this particular, you know, Les Bicyclettes and Charlie Darling, I kept doing one a year. And I've done some previously with other bands. I think if you write, well, my idea is you need to try to write a good song and then make it about Christmas. Don't write a Christmas song and just throw in words about Christmas trees and toys and presents and try not to be, you know, try to make it a good song. I think that's what I've tried to do. This doesn't always work, but no, there are only so many rhymes with toys, girls and boys, and things like that. So it's hard to write a good Christmas song.
Yeah. Are there things about Christmas or the Christmas season that inspire you, or is this a really artistic challenge to nail down Christmas songs?
I think it is. I think it can be a challenge. I think you can go down the easy route of just imagining, you know, Christmas trees and Santa Claus and sleigh rides and things like that. And other times I've thought, no, I need to. For example, there's one track on the 12 Days album, which is Boxing Day. And that came about, I was walking home one day, the day after Christmas, and I could see already people had thrown away Christmas cards and there were Christmas trees on the street. And I thought, that's it, Christmas is over, you know. And it's that whole thing of the saddest sight, you know, about Christmas is when it's over. You know,
yeah.
So I thought, okay, I'll write a song about Boxing Day and then try to write songs about New Year and things like that. And how about writing a song about going Christmas shopping, which used to be a thing. And after, right. You know, post COVID, I'm not sure that Christmas shopping is such a thing these days. I don't know.
I wonder if just sort of the whole level of heightened emotions makes it a subject for writing, and particularly even like subtle emotions, like even when you are in the process, when you are shopping, there's that
yes.
moment of choosing something and deciding, like, is this the right thing? Is
yes.
this too much? Is this too little? Is this going to land the way I hope it lands? And there's a whole lot of, like, really, on one hand, it's really low-grade stuff, But the anxiety is very real and very palpable while you're in the middle of it.
It is. I have worked in a bookshop at Christmas, and I've seen how people, you know, it was one of those stack them, you know, pile them high, sell them cheap, those right, sorts sure. of things. And they're usually celebrity autobiographies or cookery books. And you just see these things flying off the shelf and you think, oh, have you thought about that?
Yeah.
Or have you just thought that'll do, you know, I'll just buy that for this, that, and the other. And you're right. But I also have, it's also the memories. I think it's the memories of going Christmas shopping with your parents and just the excitement of the lights and the, you know, there might be a choir playing or a band playing or, you know, just that feeling. So I think a lot of it with me is sentimentality.
Sure.
It's that either remembering how Christmas used to be or how I'd like Christmas to be.
Sure.
I'd like it to be an old black and white film. You know, one of my favorite films is The Bishop's Wife with Cary Grant and David Niven. And I'd like Christmas to be that film rather than the, you know, the commercial thing it is now, you know.
Sure.
Or and has been for a long time.
How did Christmas music factor into your life as a kid growing up?
Well, I think it was one of those things where, and this may sound like a cliche, but back in the day when you only would have had one radio or one record player, and we would have had that one Christmas album. And as a family, you knew when Christmas was coming because the Christmas album would come out. And in my case, when I was small, it was the Gene Autry Christmas wow. album, which is just amazing. There's just the, and you just play it over and over and never get tired of those 12 songs or whatever it was. And then, of course, the Elvis Christmas album, which is just a delight. You know, and when you realize he recorded that, what was it, in August in Los Angeles or something.
Right. Something. Yeah.
And they had to, I think they had to recreate snow or something to put Elvis in the mood for, you know.
Yeah.
So it was that, yeah, is it a cliche? I don't know. But it's the family around the record player putting those records on. Because I think in the early days, it wasn't so commercial having a Christmas, certainly not in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't bombarded in the shops with, you know, the Christmas loop that just plays the same songs over and over and over again. It wasn't like that. I think we were more used to hearing, it's like a Salvation Army band and things like that. So again, is it my memory playing tricks? I don't know, but
sure. Whirly bird, whirly bird,
whirly bird, whirly bird.
The news is out and I've been told it came by wire from the great North Pole. I'm sure each boy and girl he heard Santa Claus has got a new whirly bird. Santa's coming in a whirly bird Christmas night in a whirly bird. So if you're good and you don't goo, the whirly bird's gonna land on your roof. Whirly bird,
whirly bird, whirly bird. I'm fascinated by this, like, because obviously being, you know, in the States, that we've had, you know, such a machine built around Christmas for so long, and it feels like longer, but like,
yes,
you know, I've written about the all Christmas radio format, like, you know, here at some point, yeah, you know, radio stations will switch entirely to all Christmas music, and it feels like it's been doing that forever, and it. Actually, first year was 1993, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
Yeah, a radio station. Yes, 93. I know that's right. It was a radio station in Phoenix, Arizona. It was the first one to do this. And so it wasn't forever, but it all just, you know, in our memory, it all backs up and all sort of crashes together. But the idea, you know, when you're here and you're living it, it feels like this is the way it is everywhere. And the idea that in the UK, there's an entirely different tradition, and that many of the songs that have become, you know, that have exhausted us never factored there. And the idea that for so many people here, Slade and Wizard mean nothing to them. Right. And which I still find astounding.
Because we get so much of it,
right?
You know, it's and it's almost as if when you watch TV programs that are set around Christmas, in the background will be Slade, will be Wizard, will be Mudd, will be Paul McCartney, and it's almost as if, and I think we haven't moved on, and I think there was in the UK. There was the Now That's What I Call Music series of compilations. And I think in the late 80s, they brought out Now That's What I Call Christmas.
Right.
And it had, for the first time, all those songs on one record. And it's almost as if time has stood still with those songs in the UK. They represent Christmas. And you just think to yourself, well, before they were written, what did we have?
Right.
I suppose we had Johnny Mathis and Bing Crosby and things like that. But you're right. And now it's, you go into a supermarket and they've got that album playing now.
Yeah.
Well, it's lazy. It's lazy. I think it's, you know, they've not thought about it, which is why I kind of like, well, what they call alternative Christmas. But then when does alternative become mainstream? Because certainly in the UK for the last 10 years, the national radio stations have been putting out this alternative Christmas music, but it's not alternative anymore. It's because now that's what you hear all the time. So,
right. Well, you know, I'm fascinated by this, but I think this is, you know, we have a version of the same thing that, yeah. You know, for a long time, there was a belief that pretty much, you know, all that, you know, almost all the canonical Christmas songs, all the favorites, were really recorded by 1964 or so or earlier. And yes. But you've had since then, you know, McCartney has become a standard. I mean, yes. That's a radio regular. That you do have Mariah Carey is 1994, and that is absolutely a regular. You know, Wham's Last Christmas is 84, and that
yes.
is also. So yeah. We have, you know, it's still from right now, that's 40 years ago.
Yes.
But at the same time, it is, you know, there was a point where it seemed impossible to get anything after 1964 or 65.
Yes.
To register as valid Christmas music.
Yes. So it was Bing Crosby and, yes, Johnny Mathis and, yeah. But I think certainly in the UK, it became a thing to get the Christmas number one
right.
in our Christmas charts. And I think the theory behind that was that people that didn't know anything about popular music, so your auntie, your uncle, would think, what can I buy, you know, what can I buy Charlie for Christmas? I know, I go into the record shop and I'll say, what's the Christmas number one? Or what's number one?
Yeah.
I've no idea, but whatever's number one, I'm sure Charlie will love it, so I'll buy it. And so it became so important to get that Christmas number one. And they were selling 4-1.
Right.
What the next record was.
Yeah.
So it became... Certainly in the era of the talent, you know, the talent contest, Simon Cowell,
sure.
Obviously be
yes.
aware of,
yes.
You know, it became so important to have that Christmas number one.
Yeah.
And it could be any old nonsense. It just, you know.
Swing back to something I want to hear more of rather than less of. And that is in 2020, you released A Morstan Tale and Other Christmas Stories. So first, what is the significance of Morstan to you?
That's where I live.
Oh, okay.
That's a village in Norfolk, which is in the East Midlands of the UK. And that's the village where I live. So I'd released that as, again, a kind of a fundraising album for the community. Just to, because I'm involved in sort of fundraising activities for the community, sort of. And it just seemed like, well, what can I do? You know, what can I do to raise money? So I did the CD and sold the CD and raised a little bit of money just to put towards community things. And I just thought it's a fun thing to do. Could I write a song about where I live and, you know, the frosted fields and stuff like that? We are deep in the countryside, which is nice. So yeah, that's what that was about. And then just trying to sort of put together my sort of favorite Christmas songs or Christmas music, as it were. So that was the thinking behind that one.
So, and this was in this 2020, and so this was during COVID.
So this was basically keeping me occupied during June, July, and August, when all the best Christmas songs, Christmas music is made. And I do remember, I think with Bethan, who's singing on Silent Night, I do remember it was one of the hottest days of August. And we're singing Silent Night, Holy Night. And it was one of those, yes, this is the right time to be doing. I think, you know, I think I did In the Deep Midwinter as well in that one. So, yeah.
That's funny.
It was a nice thing to be doing. And again, the beauty of modern technology means you can sit at home and you can still make music.
Yeah.
That was one of the nice things.
Now, I would also imagine that that thinking about 2020, which I think we're all going to end up sort of unpacking for a long time.
A long time,
but,
yes.
You know, the key line in there is you're not alone, and thinking about how, at least here, you know, how the degree to which we did, you know, spend so much time in our houses and spend so much time away from other people.
Yes.
Was there a consciousness of trying to write a song for a moment when people were feeling alone?
Yes, there was that. It's like a coming home song. I think that was what I was trying to achieve with the walking across the frosted fields and seeing the various animals in the fields. And if you can imagine a scene where you can see a house and you can see a light, and I suppose light at the end of the tunnel type thing, but that warm feeling you get from, you're out in the cold, but don't worry, over there is a place, and there's warmth, and there's companions and friends and family. And it's that, don't worry. It was, I think I was trying to be uplifting. Yes.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking that I liked the reassurance that, that even if we can't be together right now, we're still here for each other.
We're still here. Yes, exactly. It was that, it was that kind of coming home. Yes.
Yeah. We
don't worry. Don't worry. We're going to be okay. We're going to get through this. And I think almost by the end of 2020, we thought we'd got through it. And then of course we went through it again. So.
Over frosted fields I roam, where the tawny owl and blackbird have flown. Going home. Over Quayside Park in snow, marshland breezes through my t-shirt blow.
What role did Christmas music play in the start of your career?
Nothing. Nothing. No, nothing at all. At the beginning, when I started doing all this, I just wanted to be in a band.
Sure.
I was in a four-piece band, all young guys, jumping up and down, hitting our guitars as hard as we could, having a good time, not getting anywhere, but no. Yeah. It didn't really do anything until I'd almost had my career as whatever my career was. I didn't have to write songs that a management company or a record label would say, we need this, we need a hit, we need commercial, we need this, we need a chorus, we need that, this sort of thing. When that had kindly sort of died out and was all over, I could then sit down and be a bit more retrospective and start thinking about what I actually like doing. So, and that's when I started writing Christmas songs.
Did Christmas music, when you were a kid, do you think that influenced your ideas about what good music is?
Oh, definitely. I think from my perspective, knowing how to write a verse and a chorus with a really good hook, that's always been my thing. I've always tried to have melody with whatever I do. I don't know clever chords. I don't know clever guitar lines. I grew up listening to T-Rex and Slade. So I know three chords, and I know how to weave a melody around those three chords. I couldn't, you know, I'm not Steely Dan. I can't do that. So, and you say, you know, I grew up listening to bands like T-Rex and Slade, and you just get that pop thing. And I know a lot of people dismiss them as being pop and lightweight and things like that, but I love them, you know. I listen to them all the time.
Count down the days behind every closed door. 24 clues, secrets and much more. I don't want to fight again, I want a shooting star.
I have to tell you that my current favorite song, period, much less Christmas song, is a Bad Christmas cover version.
I'm glad you.
where did that one come from?
Oh, that actually, it took me about a year to do that one. Because it was actually the previous Christmas, and I was somewhere listening to Christmas music being played, and I heard of cover of Mudd's Lonely This Christmas. I don't know if you know that one over there, and it was terrible. And I don't know, just I was just in that mood. I wasn't trying to be nasty. I was trying to suggest what you should have done is you should have done one by Paul McCartney. You should have tried one by Slade. I think I mentioned in the lyrics that's what I was trying to get across. I wasn't, my sense of humor, sometimes people might think, oh, that's a bit nasty, but honestly, it wasn't. It was, you know, it was just me saying to the band, that was a bad Christmas cover.
Yeah,
you should have done one by Paul McCartney. You should have done one by Wizard, or T-Rex, or whoever. Yeah.
Now,
but I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was just some. I felt that the album was a bit was getting bogged down with a sentimentality, and there was a reason behind that. If you don't mind me sharing, that year my dad had died. And at the beginning of the year, and I was still in that sort of Christmas mode, and I was starting to think of, you know, I'm not going to have Christmas with my dad anymore. And so I think there are, yes, things like First Christmas is not a play on Last Christmas. It's the first Christmas that I'm not going to see my dad, or sure, and things like that. So there was a lot, and Every Christmas Eve as well is a song thinking about my dad at Christmas. And so I was just I was in that, and I'd set myself the task from almost from hearing, actually Bad Christmas cover version was probably, I was thinking, right, I can do an album, but it will take me 12 months probably to come up with, because, and halfway through in the middle of summer, I was thinking, why have I done this? I can't do this. You know, when you think of people like Sufjan Stevens, who just, he just knocks out Christmas song, Christmas song. I think, how are you doing this? Yeah. I can't do it. But I got there in the end. And anyway, roundabout what I'm saying, Bad Christmas cover version almost kicked it off. And it just lightened the, as does the Andy Partridge Christmas song, just lightens that mood. As I think I was just dipping into, feeling a bit too sorry for myself. Yeah.
Has anxiety about making a bad Christmas cover prevented you from doing Christmas covers? Because you really don't have many, if any.
Yes. Because because it will come back and bite you, as they say. No. I think it will. I think people will say, you're no good. Yeah. And I think it's hard because I think there are a lot of lazy covers out there by very, very well-known performers who just pick a Last Christmas or Wonderful Christmas Time and you think you're just phoning it in, aren't you? You're not, you know. So no, I don't think I would, no. apart from the traditional ones that I did with the Morstan Tale, you know, Silent Night and White Christmas and Rudolph and things like that. Apart from that, I don't think I would, no.
Christmas, you banded a terrible Christmas song. You banded a version of a 70s classic. You banded a version that all went wrong. You could have done a song by Wizard or Shaky. You might have sung a song by Cliff or Slade. Should have made a song by Paul McCartney instead of the big mistake you made.
Few threads come together in our last interview this week. Charlie Darling's song, An Indie Rock Christmas, shows up on one of the two volumes of Have Yourself a Merry Indie Christmas, a couple of British comps that were released this fall. Each one has 54 or so songs, and proceeds for the sale go to Crisis, a British nonprofit that helps the homeless. British music journalist Kevin McGrath pulled the project together, and he'll explain more about Crisis and how he found much of the music for the comp. One of his sources was Jim Goodwin's Christmas Underground site, and I talked to Jim last week. I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. One of the first songs to get my attention on Have Yourself a Merry Indie Christmas is the Swansea Sounds' Merry Christmas to Me. So let's start there. Then we'll talk to Kevin McGrath after that on 12 Songs.
I go.
First off, tell me about the project. Is Have Yourself a Merry Indie Christmas? And first off, what is the? I mean, I'm from New Orleans, and so I know this is benefiting a UK organization. But tell me about who this is benefiting first.
Yeah, Crisis is one of the leading charities in the UK that seeks to help the homeless, and we. We've supported them as a family just through small donations over the years. Particularly, they have a campaign every year called Crisis at Christmas, where they try to raise money to get homeless people to come in, have a Christmas meal, have a bed for the night, have some health checks, some ongoing guidance, and with a view to trying to help them in the future. So it's a well-established campaign in the UK. They've got a lot of celebrity supporters on their website, like Ed Sheeran and Chris Martin and whatever. So it's quite a big organization, yeah.
Right. And so how did the idea of doing an indie rock Christmas compilation come about?
Yeah. I'm a music journalist. I've been writing about music for about a decade or so. I created an album last year for the cancer hospital where I've been a patient for the last decade. And that did quite well. I raised a few £1,000. So I thought, I've always loved Christmas music. I love Christmas. I love Christmas music. It's a big part of the rituals of Christmas, you know, is to listen to the sort of same Christmas records I've been listening to since I was a kid. But I thought if I was going to do something, I'd like to do originals, to find bands that had already recorded a Christmas song or would record one specifically for the project. I didn't have a number of songs in mind. I wasn't really sure what I would find when I started to look for sort of original Christmas songs. But I soon discovered that there was many, many, many songs out there that I'd never heard that I loved. And it was then a matter of trying to get hold of as many of those as I possibly could. And it just kept escalating. I could have stopped at 40. 40 would have been a sensible album. And then someone would send a song in that I'd wanted. And I thought, yes, punch the air. I'm going to put that in 41, 42. And in the end, I had to stop. But I stopped at 108, which you can tell is a ridiculous number. I didn't even do it at 100 or 110. I just thought, I've got to stop, otherwise I'll never get this thing out. So it's 108 tracks split over two 54 tracks, digital volumes, and there's a limited edition CD, which is 16 tracks. But I had quite a few people asking if there was going to be anything on CD. And to be honest, I'm of a generation that, you know, likes to listen on to vinyl and CDs, whereas my daughters, you know, they're 99.9% listening to stuff digitally and so on. So covered both bases there, I think, yeah.
Wow. So you whittled this down. So for the CD, you whittled it down to 16 each?
Yeah.
Wow. I'd
be pretty ruthless to dispatch with 92 songs or whatever. Yeah. But I had some funding from a South African label called Subjangle. They specialize in sort of jangle pop. So I was looking for songs that would, even though they left the selection entirely up to me and they haven't wanted to get involved at all. They don't even want their name mentioned. They're just a very generous offer, no strings attached. But I thought I'd like to do something in keeping with their ethos of what would fit into their label. And there was enough songs of that kind on the album, because although it's called Have Yourself a Merry Indie Christmas, there's a lot of tracks on it that wouldn't come under the indie genre of music, but more just as independent music in general. So there's quite a lot of Americana on there, a bit of electro, some country and some folk. But most of it would be indie pop, indie rock. Yeah.
Fancy was a working girl up and down the interstate. Ronnie was a truck driver without a state plates, looking for a date.
So did you actually tap people or ask people or approach people looking for 108 songs?
Yeah.
Did you look for more than that? Did you look for more?
I just set that one day in January. That was the strange thing that started just after Christmas. That was a bit strange because I just had about 2 months solid of Christmas music and I wasn't really in the mood for Christmas music. But I thought, if I'm going to start it, I better start early because I don't know what I'm doing here. I've got no idea where to find these songs. So I just sat at the computer and started to Google things like underground Christmas songs or under the radar or alternative Christmas songs. And I managed to stumble upon some of the excellent sites that are out there, Christmas Underground and Christmas Go-Go. And there's loads of them, which surprised me. So then it was a matter of listening to those songs because there was very, very few that I knew already. So I had to sit down and listen to probably anywhere between 500 and 1,000 different songs through the year. And I then started to try and approach those artists either by a message on their Bandcamp page or Twitter or writing to their label, any way I could find to contact them. So that was a pretty arduous process. It could get a bit frustrating, and sometimes there'd be no reply and you think, shall I try again? And then I started to get something on the third and fourth try. They would suddenly come out of nowhere and say, oh yeah, I did see this a few months ago. I meant to get in touch. So I had to keep trying ones that I already tried. So it became a very long process, but it was a lot of fun. It was loads of punch the air moments when I thought, I cannot believe I've got this song. So yeah, it was great. Yeah, good fun.
Who was the first person to turn in a song and to agree?
Funnily enough, it was the American band, the Kintners, a country, sort of country folk, I guess, that sort of area they operate in. But it was interesting because I just chanced upon a song which was by an outfit called Subway Choir. And when I traced it, the person who'd written the song was from Cardiff, just 10 miles down the road from me. But Kelly Kintner of the Kintners was singing on that song. It's a lovely song. And then from that was the first one. Then I asked the Kintners if they had anything, and they did. So the first two songs were not indie songs at all, really, but they were too good to turn down. I like country music anyway, and I thought they were two beautiful songs. So that's where I started. Yeah.
Was there a time, like whether it was a time period or just sort of a moment where things kind of took energy and you started to get more people responding and you started to see what this is actually going to look like?
Yeah, a big plus for me was stumbling across Christmas Underground. I don't know if you know the site. But I could not believe how many songs were on that site. And I liked the way the chap, Jim, I think it's Jim, was writing about the songs. It was interesting to read what he was writing about as well as to listen to the songs. I found it a good site to just spend hours reading about and then listen to the songs. So once I was hearing that number of quality songs, I thought, this is practical, I can do this. I may not get everyone, but there's enough people who, I think artists, musicians, artists are generally, compassionate, generally able to see that their music can be used to, help something along, like a project for the homeless and so on. So I thought I had a good pitch, if you like, for want of a better word, that, this is a Christmas song. You know, some people at Christmas are struggling. It's not all, happy families. And, your song's already out there. Would you mind, I phrased it as saying, would you mind donating a song to a good cause? And, a lot of musicians were very, only, too eager to help. So, yeah, it became a real practical thing pretty soon into it, really, I think. There wasn't any point where I thought, oh, this isn't going to work. Because I think I came across Christmas Underground within a few weeks of starting to do it. And then they had links to all these other sites and podcasts and all manner of radio shows that did their Christmas mixes every year that I could trawl through and so on. So, yeah, there was a gold mine of stuff out there which I'd never come across. So I really enjoyed putting all that together.
At the end of November, Santa moved to New York. She rang him 2 days later, told him it wouldn't work. They'd agreed to give it a go, try long distance. Then she let him know she wouldn't give it a chance. Merry Christmas, darling, but it's all.
Was there a song or an artist that when you got a yes, you were particularly excited?
Yeah, there were some successes and some very interesting failures as well. On the successes, I this is probably a band which not many people perhaps in America would know. Not many people know them in this country necessarily, but there's a band called the Pearl Fishers, a Scottish indie band. They make music which I suppose you could say be influenced by the likes of Burt Bacharach, the Beach Boys. They sound a bit like bands like Prefab Sprout and Edwin Collins and so forth. So I've always liked the band. And their Christmas album, which they wrote, it's probably 20 years ago now, called A Sunflower at Christmas, is one of my sort of top five Christmas albums of all time. So I was determined to approach them and see if they would get involved in it, and they did. So once I got that, I thought, I cannot believe I've got them on an album I'm doing. And the same thing went for Suzzy Roach, because I've always been a big fan of the Roaches. huge fan of the Roaches. So I just dashed off an email or a Bandcamp message to her because I'd noticed that she'd recorded Christmas Love with Lucy Wainwright Roach a few years back for a retrospective album of his sister's music. And she was happy to take part. So they were the two main successes. Pete Astor, this is really an indie pop legend. He's one or two theories that he invented indie pop. He was singing with The Loft, one of the original indie pop bands, and then The Weather Prophets, who I loved. So he's on the album as well. And of the near misses, Ron Sexsmith, he was all for it, but couldn't get it done with his previous label because he didn't own the song and philosophy. But another level again, Chris Butler from The Waitresses got in touch with me. And there's always a no covers album. He got in touch with me and said, I'll let you have the song for the album if you can get Richard Thompson to record it. He'd heard Richard Thompson do a version in concert somewhere, which he sent me the link to have a look at it on YouTube or whatever. And there he was doing it. So I did approach Richard Thompson, but I never heard anything back. So that I didn't quite get there. The other people I was in touch with were the Webb Brothers, because they had a Christmas song that I liked. I didn't realize it was a cover, so it wouldn't have counted anyway. But they said, what about having a chat with our father, Jimmy Webb? He's had a Christmas album over the year, which I knew, but that didn't lead anywhere either. So there were some close shaves to some pretty big artists there. Yeah.
The cold, it is clear like a silver bell. Swiftly the little flakes are falling. Looking down from the window of
thanks to Americo Gazaway, Charlie Darling, and Kevin McGrath for the time and the talk. If you like what you hear, you can find all of their music through Bandcamp, which is one of the better digital marketplaces for musicians, since they get a bigger percentage of the sales there than they do at some other platforms. If you like this episode or 12 Songs in general, let people know about us. Talk about 12 Songs on Twitter before it turns into the Wild West, or talk about it on Mastodon, so people there will have something to do better than talk about Twitter and Mastodon. We're going to wrap up with one more from Have Yourself a Merry Indie Christmas. These are the Hitsville Drunks with JC Says JC. Talk to you next week.
Jesus Christ says, Jesus Christ, this whole place is a mess. Jesus Christ says, Jesus Christ, and I'm the Son of God, no less.